For the next 3 hours, it's Open Mind, and I am so delighted you're along because we're here to stretch yours a little bit. Perhaps give your mind something that you haven't thought about in a while. Tonight, we're going to talk about a very basic part of each and every one of us, and that is our spiritual self. Just exactly what is it? And how important is it? And our guest tonight is Kerry Williams. Kerry, welcome. Welcome to Open Mind. I'm so delighted to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here, Bill.
Put that little red button. There you go. Say it again.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here with you tonight.
I am delighted to have you here. Kerry has written some books that I think are, well, you put them in your library. They're in mine. One of them is called The Phoenix Fire Mystery. Let's write that down. And the other one is called Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And, of course, we're going to talk about the spiritual part of us. That just goes on and on and on. It seems that so many of us have the idea that our physical person here is the most important thing, and our spiritual part of it, the little energy that makes it run, is kind of secondary.
Yes, and many people do think that way at times.
And actually, it should be the other way around. Our physical person is to serve the spiritual person.
According to all of our research.
According to your research. So we're talking research here tonight.
We're talking research into all the world religions.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed all scientific data, which has nothing to do with religion per se, but confirms it.
Mm-hmm.
That what you said is indeed the fact that our physical body and our personality, which many, many people identify with as being the only existence that there is, and that little divine immortal part of us, whatever name you want to give it, higher self, the soul, spirit, is indeed the real man.
Mm-hmm.
And that this house that houses it is the physical man and the least important of our real being and our experience here on planet Earth.
Well, particularly in this society, let's just call it the Christian Judeo-society, there is, and I'm oversimplifying here, of course, the idea that we are born, physical and spiritual, we go through one lifetime, and then we cease to exist physically, and when that physical existence ceases, we go into limbo, we go to heaven.
Yes.
That's more or less the prevailing thought.
That's the modern thought, Christo-Judeo, modern Western idea.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back in history and understand a little of the early Christian thought and the before Christianity really came into its own, the Neoplatonist school.
Mm-hmm.
In which the early mythology was very well understood, indeed the symbology of what man is and the purpose of life, which seems to have, when Christianity came into being, somehow been lost.
Yeah.
So the title of our book is Reincarnation, A New Horizon, because it's new to some people who have lost the understanding or the thread of truth that has existed since time immemorial. The understanding of ancient African tribes, the Huna in Hawaii, many of what is considered ancient and very primitive is indeed very much the opposite. And some of our exciting research does cite that these people, though they live maybe very simply according to our American and Western standards, are indeed living very close to the real true life. They're living in harmony with the earth. Their understanding of survival and unity and brotherhood is a camaraderie that somehow our American civilization is always at a loss for, short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
And we take that to the world and global problems, and we still see it on that level. When we go back to the primitive tribes and we read what they've achieved with their understanding, their symbols, and their myths, we can see that it was indeed many of these ancient African or other tribes of the East and the West were indeed very, very profound. And you said it very simply earlier in the beginning of the show that we have this little inner part of us that is very profound, and people say, if it's there, why can't I know it? How do we know it exists? How do we know that we have this, call it consciousness or higher part of ourselves or higher self or inner self, that really does exist and is always operating all the time? Some people say the ability called intuition is a certain application of that inner self applied to daily living. Take it a step further, and you have what we call the great teachers of humanity that are using that full consciousness all the time, every minute of their life, to serve humanity. And when we take this worldly approach in our writing, in our research, we try to show that there were many great teachers who came to help humanity. In the Eastern realm, they're called Mahatmas, great souls. And that Eastern term is very much part of Western civilization today, because we've had many gurus coming to America trying to enlighten the Western mind. But what the West has to understand is what we have right here is very profound. If we can just undo the dogma and hear the inner meaning of the words of, let's say, Jesus the Christ, or as you mentioned earlier, the Judeo-Christian doctrines that we have right here in the West, they are very, very magnificent and in harmony with all the world religions.
Well, as you look at the Kabbalah...
Yes.
The Kabbalah, of course, is certainly explicit about the reality of reincarnation. As you look at the writings of the early elders of the Christian Church, in particular Origen and St. Augustine,
very,
very specific about the actuality or part of that teaching of reincarnation. And as you look at the world around us, there are more people that seem to understand that life goes on and you don't just get born and go to heaven or hell. I mean, you know, that's a little dull.
It's very frightening.
Yeah.
I think...
Well, that, of course, is... I always say that the burden of proof is on the detractors, and it's and the only detraction I've ever heard that this isn't so, because I don't read that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yes.
But they've never gone down and gotten into the original text of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the rest of it. And by the way, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John had some very profound things to say about the eternal spirit.
You are very indeed correct. And we do cite many instances that have appeared. Many people take it as dual meaning. Those who seek not to believe in the idea of reincarnation say that those who are reincarnationists have misinterpreted, read into it. And those who choose to ignore the fact that such a possibility exists say it isn't what the teachings say as far as Christianity. We don't like to argue. We like to take this, since this show is called The Open Mind.
Yes, sir.
That we hope listeners will take an open mind and try to understand maybe some of these ideas that are universal in nature.
Well, I wanted to touch upon the religious aspects that we're around for just a minute, because most people equate their responsibility towards spirituality in a religious sense.
Yes.
They get involved in some kind of a religion, which is to, in some way, pay homage to their spiritual growth. And indeed,
yes,
religions were designed to do that. However, we find that most religions allow you to grow spiritually, provided you do certain ceremonies, do some rote,
yeah,
and that sort of thing, dogma.
Right. When you say pay homage, you know, I often wonder, the largest institution in the Western world today is the Roman Catholic Church, and it's paying homage in indeed a very specific monetary way. Spirituality and going through the motions of going to church or going to temple or going to a Buddhist monastery, whatever religion or faith anyone may be, does not guarantee that you are going to be indeed spiritual or awaken the spiritual part of your nature.
I always say that it's a cop-out. If you do certain pieces of ceremony and certain pieces of rote and perform certain functions... A lot of people said, hey, I have done that, I have worn my cap, I have done this, I have been there, I have done the beads, and so therefore I have done my spiritual thing, and then I can go on and do whatever I want to, because I've done my spiritual thing.
Well, my question
is... The evolvement of spirituality is a never-ending quest.
As I walk down the street every day, I ask myself, if all these people are indeed doing, as you say, going to their places of worship, following the ceremonies to the letter, Going to church, going to temple, paying your dues, saying your prayers, doing the worship, idol worships in India, whatever it is, then why don't we have millions of great humanitarian teachers here on earth right now? If everybody is achieving spiritual development, why can't we see it?
Why is it that man's inhumanity to man at this point in time has never been greater than it is now? We're not going to count the 38 or 40 wars that are going on. Battlefield wars. We're going to talk about also the wars that go on within the shimmering skyscrapers of Los Angeles and Chicago and New York among those people there.
Well, it's an interesting way of
saying
it. And
all around it.
The man's inhumanity, the man...
has never been greater.
Well, we have very many people here in existence, in incarnation right now, in a body, experiencing something. And it's really interesting that all the great religions of the world are all predicting something to be happening at this period in our evolution. Always, all the religions, whether it's Christianity waiting for the return of Christ or the second coming or whatever it may be, something critical is occurring on our planet
toward
now.
The end of this century.
Right. Psychics are predicting it.
Well, it's certainly a part of the litany of the Christian writings that something would happen at about this time.
But it isn't only the Christian writing.
But also, it coincides with a lot of other writings.
Exactly.
But it certainly came up in the teachings of Jesus and in the teachings of John, as found in Revelations, that we're approaching a critical time.
But so there are many cycles. And
the Hopi Indians certainly have some very, very interesting things to say. And John Voight has been working very closely with them. There's kind of an amassing of things that are happening with the Hopis. And we hope to have John and the Hopis on here in the next couple of weeks if we can get them all settled down at one time and talk about what that very pristine and spiritual group of people have to say.
It's interesting. There was a special on the other day in which the Easter Islanders were found to be linked to the Ashkenazi Indians, and that they were indeed a carryover from the Eastern Islanders, because many of their teachings, their symbolical drawings and etchings, and the teachings that they offer themselves are indeed one and the same. I think that from one part of the United States to the other, you know, there's this thread of truth that prevails.
Well, it's kind of a fascinating thing. So we do kind of, maybe we step on some people's toes, but we're not here to step on your toes. We're here to put something on the table for you to discuss, for you to think about, because there's a lot more to what's going on than heaven and hell in your life.
Yes.
And in your afterlife and your pre-life.
Yes, I'd like to tell a little story here. Not to the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, he used to people fear going to hell, but his fear was of perpetual heaven, which is a different way of looking at things. And I think his own words stand to reason. You know, they offer an understanding that, said in his words, are awakening to many minds. He said, "When I was a boy, the thought of heaven used to frighten me more than the thought of hell. I pictured heaven as a place where there would be perpetual Sundays with perpetual services, from which there would be no escape, as the Almighty, assisted by cohorts of angels, would always be on the lookouts for those who did not attend. It was a horrible nightmare. The conventional heaven with its angels perpetually singing nearly drove me mad in my youth, and made me an atheist for 10 years. My opinion is that we shall be reincarnated." Now, people think of heaven today as a glorified place to be, or what is portrayed as being a heavenly state, when indeed a lot of our research, and we do go into it quite thoroughly, of people who have had near-death experiences and what they experience in these after-death states indicates quite a revelation that people need to understand.
And the out-of-body travelers are also telling us a whole new set of things that you have to deal with.
Well, a lot of people who travel who have out-of-body experiences that are not near-death experiences, we don't really cover. We only cover those that are documented near-death experiences.
Those are the near-death. But I go through the body of evidence that comes from the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences, Robert Monroe and his group. This is a very concerted scientific group of people.
I must say that he was the one who did the research with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Right.
Who I'm happy to say wrote the introduction to Reincarnation, the Phoenix Fire Mystery, which is now available again in paperback. And what she experienced out of all the people that were there, she's the only one who had an out-of-body experience induced. And that's where she experienced the concept of Shanti Nilayat, final home of peace. And her life work and her goal, indeed today, is to help people achieve that peace. Dying people.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's dying children with AIDS. And she's done more for humanity to help people not be afraid of death than anyone else I know. And in the beginning of our book, in The New Horizon, we constantly bring up this issue because many, many young people today are in a critical state of disillusionment of living.
Mm-hmm.
Suicides are rampant among elementary school children.
Drug use
and abuse. Family abuse.
Well, using a drug is abuse.
Yes, right, it is. But to the point, I mean, of overdosing.
Yeah.
But what we have found in a lot of the research, and such gentlemen as Viktor Frankl and other psychologists today said there's nothing greater at the root or cause of all the psychoses and neuroses of the world today. It stems from one thing only, is the conclusion, and that's the fear of death. And that's why I attribute Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work as being very great for our humanity, because she's helped people overcome the fear of death. She experienced at Monroe what it feels like to die.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of her repertoire of that experience there. And because of that, she has taken that work to help people understand death as a process, as a transition, not as an end. It's only an end to, as you said earlier, the shell, the physical body.
This little space that we have to live in.
Yes, it's quite bulky.
Yes, very restricted.
Yes.
Sometimes
but we
it
go
hurts.
On. Yes, for some people. Yes, it's true. There are some people that I've met along the way in this work that have said they remember being born.
Hmm?
They remember being born. And at the time of birth, they remember what a horror it was to try to move around this heavy body. Because they also could remember what it was like to be free of a body.
And not have it at all.
Right. Right before birth and before conception.
And I've talked to some who remember the conversations that their mother had while they were in the womb.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, going back even before they had ears.
Yes.
That they could understand this.
Well.
I think the fact that the sperm and the egg get together and all at once a magical thing happens. A master electrician, a master chemist, a master biologist, a master of many disciplines goes to work and makes this little body. And it was not mother. And all she did was provide the raw materials in the safe place. And it was not God, necessarily. It was the spiritual intelligence that took advantage of that moment.
Yes, but evolution or creation, let's say, happens on two levels. The physical body has to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Mother and father are important in the contributing.
Well, certainly, they put all of these little elements
right,
together.
Right, they put the elements together. But then, on the more refined or ethereal level, is the soul coming to inhabit that body.
That's where the intelligence is.
Exactly, because many researchers have found now, and it's been said in varied bodies of knowledge, that there is an agreement between the mother, the father, and the future, what's called incarnating ego, that part of us that is immortal, that never dies, that experiences and learns and retains the essence of the experience,
right,
to go on. And all of that is a part of us now.
You know, sometimes the sperm and the egg get together and there's no life.
Yes.
Because there was no intelligence that decided to take advantage of that moment.
Or it did and it didn't happen. The opportunity wasn't
too
right. We found a very interesting story that was written about a young little boy that died, Eduardo. I don't know if you remembered, about 1977, 78. He said he didn't know why he chose a sick body to come into this life. But he did know that dying was only a transition. And that he had a special mission here. And his mother, ever since this child was very young, had to take him to the Eastern schools. He was a Buddhist, and he understood the precepts and the tenets. And when he was taken to a Buddhist monastery, they recognized him as being a great soul. And he made a tape recording, before he died, and he told people to not be afraid. That if they could let go of their attachment to this physical body, which we think all life is just this...
Yeah, is this all there is?
Two arms, two legs.
Yes.
And to let go that there was something far greater beyond. The thing is, we get a glimpse of death every single night.
Mm-hmm.
And we can take the smaller example of our waking-sleeping cycle and deep sleep and compare that to living and dying and being reborn. We get to practice this lesson every night of our life, as long as we have this body. And people, you know, they wonder, why can't we remember who we were? Indeed, we are everything that we ever thought. We are a composite of all of our thoughts, actions, and deeds. Everything we've experienced in all of our past lives.
And who knows how long that has been?
According to the secret doctrine written by Blavatsky, the average is... Average incarnation, between incarnations, is 5,000 years. Average. Some of us have been here thousands of times already. And, of course, in the dating of the planet Earth is always in question at this time. But we've all lived many, many times before.
We didn't have to always live on planet Earth, you know.
No. But the only volume or information that I know that deals with that issue, and it only deals with the evolution of this planet Earth, is The Secret Doctrine, written by Blavatsky.
Yeah, that's a must book for everybody's...
Well, Einstein read it and studied it thoroughly, and was doing some research in which an article was written up in Santa Barbara in which he it was stated that one of his comments he had to write to Niels Bohr and said, if you have any questions that you can't solve, just flip over The Secret Doctrine. You're bound to find the answer.
There's something in her, in her work. My guest tonight is Carrie Williams. Obviously, we're talking about reincarnation. She's written two books on it, Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And the other one is The Phoenix Fire Mystery. Very, very provocative things for you to read. Let me give you the numbers if you'd like to talk to Carrie. She has written a book herself, or is a co-author of a book called Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. And then there is Reincarnation, The Phoenix Fire Mystery. I said that you wrote that, but you didn't write that, did you?
No, my co-author is Sylvia Cranston, and she's worked on three prior works, Reincarnation and World Thought, Reincarnation East-West Anthology, Reincarnation... The Phoenix Fire Mystery, and then as with her co-author Joseph Head,
uh-huh.
And I became a new member of the team with Reincarnation, A New Horizon.
All right, so...
I just wanted people to understand...
Let's get it
there's
straight.
There's been many, many years of research.
We don't want to give you a book you haven't written.
Yeah.
Exactly, yourself. Okay, let's go to our callers and see what they have on their mind. Warren, you're on.
Hi. I had a couple of questions, and before I posed the questions, I wanted to see if we agreed on a couple of precepts. One, that words create and thoughts create. Could we agree on that?
Okay, can I add to that a little bit?
Sure.
The co-founder of the Theosophical Movement was William Pugh Judge, and he said a very profound statement that I like very much, and I'd like to share that with you. He said, use with living care those living messengers called words. So does that indeed mean we are in agreement?
Yes, it does.
Well, we do know that a thought is in the virtual state.
Yes.
That a thought is energy.
Yes.
And you create energy with your thoughts.
Yes.
And, of course, words are preceded by thoughts.
Well, words, there are thoughts, not only thoughts, but vibration of sound, which is also another form of energy.
So your great task in life is to make sure that your thoughts are in harmony with the universe.
Yes,
okay.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, so the concept behind the music of the spheres in Pythagoras.
Yes.
All right. The questions that I have deal with not a disagreement in anything you say about reincarnation, but a query, as it were. When you're done with what you described as your spiritual thing, what next? My problem is, when we talked about organized religion, you understood that they had all their rituals and everything else. In dealing with New Age thought, as it is, what I see happening is there are also, like Blavatsky, and theosophy, schools of thought that supposedly or purportedly teach people how to deal with a separate reality. Whether it's Carlos Castaneda or Blavatsky doesn't really matter. What I don't really hear anybody talking about is the fact that even when the whole journey is done, when you come really back to it, he realized that the ultimate teacher was always the self. And what I don't hear anybody saying is that that ultimate teacher being the self is always there, and it takes the quiet time to understand that. And it's too proselytized or bastardized that you need a guru. And it's not true.
It is absolutely not true. You get 5 stars in my book, Warren, on that one, for whatever that is worth.
No, I think we're both in agreement with you here tonight. The self, as you said, is what has been called the self. Let's clarify it for people who may not understand what we understand, and that is that the self is the divine immortal part to our nature. The self is an individuality, is never really finished with experience. It is an endless stream of existence and experience, a cyclic coming and going, coming into a body, coming into a world, and then periods of rest on the single individual level, like I said, at night, on the life level, death, and then on a global planetary level, what's been called in the Eastern parlance, let's say, a manvantara, great period of time in which there's a manifestation of Earths and globes and all types of life forms, and then there's a period of rest on that great and grand level. But the self always is, even during those periods of rest. It never ends. And that's a concept that people can't or may have a very hard time understanding, that, as Einstein said, distance and time and space are forever in the eternal now. The only place that time exists in a linear fashion is on the physical plane here on planet Earth. And then when you're not attached to the physical plane or with yourself uninhibited by a physical body or in the after-death states or whatever name you want to call that state, we are completely in tune with all that there is to know, all the knowledge of the universe. People can experience that, as you said, in quiet times. The concept of meditation is truly an individualized experience that has to be done alone, but not meditating on a candle or meditating on I want to levitate off the ground, but indeed focusing your concentration on the aspect of you that is divine. That we are divine individuals that have a potential that we have barely tapped, and we can get to know that. And in that sense, we are our own teachers. It's the Eastern, let's say, gurus or whatever that have come to the West and tried to tell Americans or the Western mind that they need a teacher. Many, many people believe that. But what's happening today is many, many of those gurus that have came flooding in from India to America are slowly waning away. And eventually, we all have to find out that we have to make our choices, that we are responsible for every choice and decision we make, and that indeed what's called the law of karma will be operating. It's a law of equilibrium. It seeks to establish balance and harmony. Just like you said, the harmony of the spheres, we have to be in harmony with the 7 principles or 10 principles, depending upon what body of knowledge you want to read, that compose our being.
Okay.
Sometimes whenever you look to a guru, whether he's a Christian guru or a Western guru or whatever, what you're doing is copping out and assigning the responsibility you have for your own spiritual involvement to somebody else, which is nothing more than a cop-out.
Well, sometimes cop-out is a little harsh.
I use harsh words every now and then.
Yes, we try not to be so harsh, because there are a lot of people who have searched, found a teacher of some sort, whatever name you want to give it, have learned a lesson, has learn something that they could take away with them, and moved on.
Well, that's the idea. You need to be taught, or you need... But there's a lot of teaching that happens.
Yes.
Could I interject one thing?
Sure, please do.
I'm in agreement with you on all points, except when people have found a guru, whatever background they might come from, and when they give them something that is spiritually correct and they take them to another step, I believe in a sense that's also harmful, in that it takes them again to the next point that they've got to go outside of themselves to find someone to show them how to find out who they are.
Okay, let's...
Now, I don't have the answer. I'm not trying to pretend that I do.
But let's say that no one really takes anyone anywhere. People can explain something. People can tell you to read something. People can tell you to chant up and down and stand on your head. It's up to the individual to go through the motions and do the effort on their own. If they have an experience because someone told them to do something, they earn the experience themselves.
I'm in agreement, but why I ask for the agreement on the precept that words are thoughts and thoughts create is in that when you accept the reality of the guru in its constant state, just the fact of the guru, you negate the self. And that may be an extreme point.
I understand what you're saying, but in actuality...
And how do you overcome the fact... I'm trying to be harsh.
No, no, I'm just saying
that
we... No, we all, as individuals, walking down the street, shopping in the supermarket, let's bring it down to a very practical level. When we pay our money to the checker, that checker and ourselves is experiencing something. Every person, every thought, everything we do, everything we say, every individual we meet has something to offer us if we are available and open to that. Do you understand what I mean? So, indeed, we are all each other's teachers if we could just see that.
You do have to have a teacher, from whether it is a book or whether it is a guru, or to start the wheels of perception working in your mind. Now, you may be able to, out in the stream, figure it out all by yourself.
Yes.
I can't.
But
not
the chances are you may need a little jump start there.
But the greatest teacher, it's been said, is nature itself.
Right.
The beauty
of
nature.
I've had a lot of teaching from the program. I heard about T. Henry Morey and Nikola Tesla and the Bedini machine and things that... And when you were talking about the master electrician and the chemist and the rest, I relate everything that the alchemist did back to what we call science now.
There you are.
And it all comes around in the cycle. So I'm not trying to say that I'm a perfectionist, and I'm not really putting it down.
No one thinks you are, Warren.
I'm trying to pose a question because I see a problem.
Well, I don't think when you listen to someone or you read anything, we have to, all of us have to take what we hear, what we read, assimilate it, absorb it, experience it, and choose for ourselves if it's within what we want as our repertoire to keep with us. If we don't, we discard it. We take the essence of the lesson, and it's finished. It's been said that when the lesson is learned, the necessity ceases. And I think we all can reflect back upon our lives and realize that many, many times we make the same error again, whether it's in judgment or decision or whatever. Because sometimes it's very easy to fall into a groove of what's comfortable. And it's very hard to change an outlook or acquire a new perspective. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. If I could ask a last question.
Well, it's a good question, and we have to run on. Make it very quick.
The Bedini machine, has that moved on?
Oh, yes. It's running along.
Good.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind on a Saturday night. With me is Kerry Williams, and we're talking about reincarnation.
To them quite often. And may I speak to Kerry, please?
I am right here.
Thank you.
It's more fun to talk to her than me.
A couple of years ago, I was in a class. The teacher was teaching us reincarnation, or telling us about it. And I did go under, and when I related how I saw myself, which was in Russia, and how I was in a sleigh going to this great big ball. And I even described myself, and I was a doctor, and I was married to this officer in the Army. And I described the details of the ballroom and everything. But what bothered me was that he told me I had a good imagination or that I could write a book. And I really saw all this and saw myself there. And I was wondering, I feel that you're very qualified, and I wanted to ask what you thought about
this. Well, let me ask you very quickly, Lil. Now, this was something that you just perceived all by yourself without any kind of inducement.
Of course.
Not going into any kind of regressive state at all. It just came to you. You were able to somehow or another break down these barriers.
Well, let's clarify. When you said you went under, what do you mean by
that? I was in meditation or hypnosis or whatever you want to call it.
Ah, you were being hypnotically regressed.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I did it myself. Nobody was doing it to me.
Right.
After
you took this class on reincarnation, did they teach you how to do this?
No, he just brought it up, like that he had once been whatever he was, a monk or something.
Right, but the steps for you to go under, you did all on your own, is that it?
That's right.
Okay. Oftentimes, people who have what I call spontaneous experience on their own can be one of two things. And we, in our books, we do indeed warn against hypnotic regressions because oftentimes when people are hypnotically regressed, two things happen. One, they're definitely on a different level linked forever to the hypnotist.
No.
Yes.
I wasn't...
I'm just trying to explain what happens when people are hypnotized. The second thing is, oftentimes when people have some sort of experience while being hypnotized, they can be actual experiences of another life. You can be experiencing what's known as the astral light or the Akashic record, which is a record that exists and records history, to put it simply, everything that happened on the planet since its beginning. And, or you can be experiencing something that may have happened to you in another lifetime. The problem with many adults and why we choose to cite the research of young children in our effort is because adults have done a lot of reading. They've seen many, many movies, many shows, heard many songs, which conjure up images, as our earlier phone caller mentioned, the power of words themselves and sounds. And so it's very hard to really know for sure if that was an actual experience. It is said in our research that people, when the time is right, they will remember, just as indeed you may have. Remember when the time is right, what's called spontaneous recall. They will see their past.
He did ask me if I had anybody, any relative or anyone, and I do have an aunt that was a doctor in Russia, and why he put that together, associated it with me, I can't understand.
Maybe he's done some reading and has found out, as some of our research indicates, that oftentimes people reincarnate to areas where they have been before. And so maybe that's why he asked that. But
I had never, in my lifetime, I never even was in Russia.
No, I understand. I sincerely cannot say whether indeed it was a true experience, that you remembered a past life or not. And no one can actually do that except a true seer, such as an individual like an Edward Casey. There are very few true seers that can read the astral light and tell you for sure that indeed was your experience in your last life. When you experience these recalls, as they may be, obviously they're happening maybe for a reason.
Does that help you a little?
Yes, it does somewhat.
All right.
Well, there's no way I can give you a confirmation.
Can you explain anything about reincarnation in your book? The Phoenix.
Yes, in both books we explain many incidences of reincarnation. In the Phoenix Fire Mystery,
I did get a booklet from Edgar Casey's Foundation. I think they are selling your book.
Yes, they do, indeed. They like our research very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it does explain a lot of how reincarnation works. And it not only explains that, but it also explains how it's affected people's lives. Great people, musicians, poets, artists, musicians, anybody you can think of, poets, how these concepts have enriched and helped people's lives.
Also, there is quite a group of people now that are involved in what we would call past life therapy.
Yes.
That we do carry over some physical and mental problems from previous lives. But you don't know about those problems until you delve into the previous life itself. And once you understand that, there is a body of evidence showing that that does work.
Well, what I can say is that the lessons that we need to learn are always before us, and that we always have to remember that we always have to exercise our free will and free choice. Predestination or fate isn't what people make it out to be. we determine our destinies, and we all have to remember that, that our lives can change in one moment by exercising our own free will, choice, and determination.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because some people say, oh, it was destined to be, yeah.
No, I mean, there are...
Well,
you
it's usually a script you wrote, hon.
Well, you know, many people say, have in dreams, a lot of things can happen in dreams. There are many levels of dreams, and sometimes they're warning dreams.
Now, there's a lot of that.
Yes, I've had that experience.
Yes, well, just consider yourself to have your experience. And some people don't understand, and many people are jealous and want to have it, too.
Lil, thank you very much for contributing tonight. We have two more hours to go with Kerry Williams tonight. Our subject is reincarnation, and the door is open. Get it out on your... Get it out. We're here for that. We'll be talking to Lance in just a moment after the news.
Each and every one of you do. And we donate them to libraries around the world, medical libraries as well as public libraries, to make these books available to people who cannot afford to buy them on their own. So my co-author and I... call us a selfless work. Neither one of us take one penny from the assets of the royalties generated by the effort of writing these books.
So you've done a lot of research. You've written some very skilled books that have a lot of fruitful things in them. You sell them, and you don't keep any of the money.
No.
That's
but my co-author's
difficult.
Been doing this for over 25 years.
That's very difficult for people to understand, Carrie.
Yes, it is.
Why do you do that?
Well, we feel that the strength of the book comes in the ability to do it selflessly.
Mm-hmm.
And by being selfless and not doing it for the money generated by the book, it has maintained a magnificent service to humanity. It's a very hard subject to sell because we don't write about personal opinion or our own personal experiences, which a lot of people like to do in books like this. That are considered very scholarly or historical or factual, don't stay in print. But we sincerely believe, because of our approach being correct, the books have remained in print. The Phoenix Fire Mystery came out in 1977. It's been in print all this time, except for a few months when the Phoenix, the Reincarnation and New Horizon came out. And indeed, now that the Horizon's been out 1 year, the Phoenix Fire Mystery is back into print and paperback to make it easier for everyone to buy. And in addition to that, we even drop our royalties and lower our amount that is received in order to make the price very, very low to people who want to buy them.
So you're trying to serve
it's a double-ended reason to try to make the book available, the information available, so people can grow and have more meaning to their lives.
In service to man.
Yes. In the bottom line is we seek to help humanity.
Very good for you, Carrie. Let's go to Lance. We promised him about 10 minutes ago we'd get to him next, and Lance, we did not lie. We're here.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I had a few questions for your guest tonight.
Go ahead.
To start off with, like, everybody is endowed with, you know, a spirit or some sort of a driving force that keeps that person alive, you know, continue to have the will to live and continue and whatnot. I was just curious, you know, when a person is near death, you know, or passes on to his maker, as the Judeo-Christians might say, do you have any inclination as far as what your beliefs are, what happens to that driving force that keeps that a person alive once the moment of death is incurred?
I understand. You said everyone is endowed with a spirit. I'd like to say that we're really all divine. Each and every one of us has a potential of becoming a living God, as great as a Jesus the Christ or a Buddha or anyone else.
Or the creator of the universe. We are actually a part of that.
Yes. But as far as your next question is, what happens to all of this at death?
Yes. All this living energy, what happens to it?
It's transformed. It says that the reason why bodies grow old and we age is because of the resistance of the life force flowing through us. Like a capacitor in a light bulb, you know how filament gives light because of the electricity flowing through it? Well, it's the same principle as life. We have the life force or the life principle flowing through us, which is indeed very electromagnetic, and our physical body eventually wears out because of the resistance of this life force flowing through us. At that time, our lower principles, which is the physical body, is part of it, dies, or what appears to be dead, freeing the higher principles that are a part of ourselves to go on and experience other planes of existence. Do you understand that? There's a part of us that lives in both the physical world and the non-physical world, the visible or the invisible. And that is called the soul in many religions. That part goes on and keeps experiencing. It has its own consciousness. And the people who have experienced that here in life are the people who've had what's known as near-death experiences. They have all had this very unique experience with full consciousness of realizing they are not their physical bodies, that their consciousness, their ability to see and hear, can function without a physical body. Do you understand that?
Yes. Do you also believe that this driving force can manifest itself in other beings? Or, like some people say, you may have this energy show up in another person. You know?
Okay. What you're talking about is...
walk-ins.
Well, walk-ins or being possessed. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yes. I mean, you may have some character traits of another person.
Okay.
You know?
You are your own individuality.
Right.
There's nothing stronger than you that is in your own body. But that link between, let's say, your higher self and your physical body can be weakened. And that, there's interesting experiences that happen. Sometimes people who do too many drugs have a loosening of that. People who drink. In our book, Phoenix Fire Mystery and the New Horizon, we cite a case of a Sergeant George Ritchie who was pronounced dead for 9 minutes. It's very nice for us and for him that he was in the Army. So
right.
It's a government document. And while he was dead, or pronounced dead for these 9 minutes, he left his body and was taken on a celestial tour. On that tour, one of the places he was taken to was a bar. And when he entered the bar, he could see people sitting there drinking. And he, of course, was not in his physical body, but what's known as his astral body, which is ethereal, which can't be seen or touched by the ordinary human eye. And while he was watching these people drink, he saw what's called disincarnated entities diving in and out of the heads of the people who were drinking. Okay? Now, what happens when you drink, according to many schools of thought, is that you sever the connection between your astral and your physical body, your higher principles and your physical self. And when that state becomes weakened, it is possible for these disincarnated entities, which are hovering on what's called the astral plane, very close to Earth, they're earthbound, take an opportunity to prey on this weakened state.
Yes, it's like you're saying, like your body is your temple and any foreign substances that don't belong is sort of interfering with
the
processes, you know.
Would this same thing be true to someone who is on, like, cocaine or some of the drugs?
Any drug.
For instance, we notice quite often in cocaine users that there is a form of schizophrenia develops where there is just a sudden radical change in
yes.
the personality.
Yes.
So you call it schizophrenia.
Yes, I know there's many schools of thought, including Freud, that really wanted to delve into this understanding of reincarnation, including Carl Jung, understood that we are more than just a physical person. Personally, I seem to feel that schizophrenia may at times be two personalities mm-hmm. occupying one person, one body.
Or maybe an interloper that gets in there for a
yeah,
minute.
Right, in and out. But the thing is, the only person who can take control of their body is the individual who owns it. And it takes a lot of work to undo that loosening that has occurred.
You can't get rid of them.
By a lot of work. A lot of
yeah.
people call, and it reminds me of sometimes the story of the Son of Sam, not to bring that up,
mm-hmm.
but he said, there are demons in my head making me do this. And very few people, you know, many people thought he was just crazy.
Didn't go well with the jury.
As a reincarnationist, who I believe and think that he indeed was telling the truth, that he was not totally under control of his own higher principles, and that somehow he got pervaded by entities that prey. In seances, which are very unsafe, the medium goes into a trance and is literally usually taken over by these disincarnate entities that can mimic the astral light. people think they're talking to a deceased relative when it's nothing more than an astral shell playing games on the emotions of the people that are there.
Having fun with you because they have nothing else to do.
Well, they have a body to use. That's the point.
That's the point.
They wait for a human body to experience.
But we do have other examples, Lance, which I think are quite startling.
Yes.
There's a gentleman outside of Phoenix who was a lineman.
Uh-huh.
Working on high-tension lines. And he was... He caught 33,000 volts.
And he lived to talk about it?
And, well, he not only lived to talk about it, he was a simple lineman. He did survive the shock, which was quite unusual. And as he got back into his life, he was a changed person altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And is today one of the leading theoretical physicists for NASA. And he never, ever took physics courses in his life.
I was just curious about something before I go here. Like, everybody has, you know, free choice. You were stating something about Son of Sam, you know, trying to rationalize some of the things that he did. You know, everybody, according to the Christians, everybody has a free choice. You know, make decisions whether it's good or bad. And whatever you do is governed with what you think or how you have an outlook on life itself, you know.
Well, good or bad is a relative thing here.
Yes, we agree with the free choice.
Yes.
What did you want to say?
Well, I wanted to, you know, say as far as that goes, like, you know, what you do on this, you know, Earth, you know, it's going to finally catch up to you sometime in the afterlife.
Exactly. Well, not even in the afterlife, right here on Earth. It says, as St. Paul said, "Brethren, be not deceived. God is not mocked. As a man soweth, so shall he also reap."
That's right.
That's what you do will come back to you, which is in conflict, really, with the idea of vicarious atonement.
All right, comes around, goes around.
Exactly right.
You know, Justinian had a great problem with this.
Yeah.
He and his wife, Theodora, who was the great whore of Rome, had killed 600,000 people because they wouldn't be Christians.
It was Justinian who created the 13 anathemas.
Yes.
Who held the Pope hostage, who created the any preexistence of the soul, would be an anathema and eventually probably lead to death later on. And so Justinian, as you said, did indeed have a problem and really affected the whole course of Christianity today.
Yes, I mean, there's like...
One way to get rid of reincarnation was just to take it out of the books.
Yes.
And that basically is what
make it
did.
Anathema.
Yes,
right.
That's basically what it is.
Just like the Christians believe when you pass on from this earth, you get your reward in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they act like they say, if your name is not in the book of life, you know, you got no other choice but to go to the end of the world, as they say. You know, mm-hmm. But it's practically the same thing what you're saying.
I believe that the concept of heaven and hell, the counterpart, really doesn't exist, that there are stages in the after-death states which people have defined by their own experiences, which we cite through the work of many researchers such as Dr. Jan Stevenson, Dr. Moody, and many others, that have these experiences to help people understand that hell is a state of purgatory. The Bible talks about purgatory, you know, but it doesn't mean that it's an indefinite state. Once you go through that state, you shed your earthly attachments and get rid of all the earthly desires and things that could be very painful to let go of, you move on.
Right. That sounds like the Catholic doctrine. They have heaven, purgatory, limbo, and hell.
Well,
it gets confusing.
We say that everyone goes to heaven. Mm-hmm. No one is excluded.
You go where your consciousness takes you for the first trip up
right.
there.
Well, you create your after-death states, really, by the life you live.
Yeah, that's right.
Because
right.
The after-death states are an assimilation of your thoughts that you generated during life.
Right.
Does that help you, Lance?
Yes, but that's right. Okay, thanks for talking to me.
All right.
Have a nice night.
Thank you for checking in. We're 21 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Saturday night. It's open mind. Saturday night, Kerry Williams is with me. We're talking about reincarnation, and while that was going on, we were just talking about the regression work that goes on. How valid is regression in your estimation, Kerry?
Well, we really don't estimate it, but we do investigate the research that investigates that information. And one of the leading researchers is Ian Stevenson. He's found out that people who go through hypnotic regression, oftentimes what's experienced, as I said earlier to one of the questioners, is that it can be colored by our daily reading, everything we've ever seen, television, movies, articles we've read, pictures
of
travel. But if it's not, then indeed it's an actual experience. I mean, we have a very good example that we all are aware of, our dear friend Shirley MacLaine, you know, spent a lot of effort to recall her past lives and has indeed remembered many of them. Now that she's gone through all the experience of remembering many of her past lives, she's at the point now where she says you have to be in the now.
That's right.
You know, so what good are all the details? When people ask me about hypnotic regression, wanting to know who they were, who their mother was, who their father was, who their boyfriend is, I say, tell me everything you did from the minute you were born till your first birthday. None of us can do that. So why clutter our minds with facts and details that are really irrelevant? Mahatma Gandhi taught that it's a blessing to forget, as did many others, that if we were to be caught up and cluttered with the facts and details of the last 100 or 500 incarnations here, we wouldn't be able to deal with now.
Yeah, of what value is it? I think probably it will come to you if there is some value in approving your life now.
Yes.
In some way.
Well, let's look at the example of Gautama Buddha. In the book, The Light of Asia, or the story of Siddhartha, that was a story of his life made into a film that probably many people have seen. He sat under the Bodhi tree and remembered his past 555 incarnations. Why? For one reason, to remain a loving, compassionate teacher. To realize that he made the same mistakes that each and every one of us make along the path of our evolution to this divine state that we're all capable of at any time we choose to enter the path and become. The potential is there all the time. So the reason for recall is to remain compassionate and loving, not to judge or condemn anyone, because everything is a learning experience.
And an evolving experience.
An evolving experience.
Which is what it's all about.
Exactly.
To learn how to deal with energy is what it
yes.
basically gets
well,
out.
We are energy.
All right, Steve, you're on.
Good morning.
Hi.
Ms. Williams, General Patton believed very strongly in reincarnation. He believed he had fought under the Greeks, under the Romans, and, you know, that's why he felt so at home when he was out on the battlefields of Europe, because he felt he'd been there before and he believed he had been there before.
You're indeed correct, and we do cite some of his own words in both of our books.
Now, is it more rare than common that someone should be reincarnated and lead the same life again and again and again, as General Patton believed he had always been a warrior spirit?
Let's take your analogy of leading, being a general. People pick up where they left off. If you want to be a military career, you may pick up on a military career. If you want to be a Mozart, you'll continue in music. If you want to be a Picasso, you'll continue in art. These people, what's called genius or these child prodigies, as a reincarnation, so we state that they are just picking up where they left off. The skills and talents were acquired many lifetimes before, and it's an ever onward process. So if somebody felt an affinity for a military career, it would make sense, if we look at all the other examples, that they indeed would choose to come back if they could and pick up what was already a part of their repertoire, a skill already learned.
Uh-huh. And how about the emotional makeup of someone? Let's say someone's a politician this life and, let's say, a working class person. You know, you go to a job every day. How about if the person, let's say, for myself, I'd always believed I lived an earlier life. I believed the person who I was had not died peacefully. In other words, didn't die of old age in bed and such. I went to a medium, and they told me, I just asked them about a past life. And basically, the emotional makeup of this person, and in the past life, he said I was a woman. The emotional makeup of this person was exactly my emotional makeup at the time. I mean, if the person was, temperamental, it exactly the same, right down. It was so...
Are you saying that your emotional makeup today, now, in this life, is exactly the same as the person in your past life?
At the way he described it, the mood alterations, ups and downs, and totally exact. And plus the fact that, I had felt this person not die peacefully, and he also said that this person that I had been in this past life had been murdered. And I had told him nothing except tell me about the person who I had been before.
I understand. phobias, young children that have phobias today are manifesting fears that have maybe probably nothing to do with this lifetime at all. Fear of water, fear of heights could indeed have to do with something that happened in a previous life. I have to say to you and all other people who go to mediums that to find a very good medium is very, very hard. And my co-author and myself were in New York at the Americana Hotel doing a lecture, and there was a psychic fair going on simultaneously. We had one young man come up to us begging us to please tell him who he was in a previous life, because he had just been to a psychic that told him that he was a henchman for Hitler, and he was ready to kill himself right here on the spot. And we had to take him to someone who we felt could undo that harm and see the Akashic record clearly and help him understand that he went to three different psychics that day, and each one of them told him something else. But when somebody told him that he was Hitler's henchman, he was ready to believe that one,
yeah.
You know, instead of what the other one said.
Taking the worst possible scenario.
Yeah,
a lot of people do that in life.
That's why we encourage people. It said we're our memory of our past lives is with us all the time, but hidden away and protected. There's a Greek myth that says we're bathed in the waters of Lethe, the river of forgetfulness, for a reason, so we can deal with the now. And when we are ready, I'll take it for what it is and don't get stuck in dwelling upon it, and go on and live your life to the best of your abilities right now.
Oh, no, I was just curious. Another one more question. You've been quoting, you spoke earlier about the gurus who came to try to...
flood the Western world.
Right.
Give
now,
us some other thought.
Isn't one man's truth another man's fearsay? I mean, somebody says now, what I say that somebody said such and such, it's hearsay. Now, everyone is supposed to find the truth. Now listening to other people, his truth doesn't have to be my truth.
You're exactly right. Each person has their own path to tread. And another person's path doesn't mean it's your path. And many people try to follow in the footsteps of Shirley MacLaine saying, if I do what she does, I go to Peru and I sit in a hot tub and a mineral bath and I meditate for 4 days or whatever, then I'm going to have the experience she had. It doesn't work like that.
So why bother trying... Now, your organization is trying to, you know, enlighten people to be aware, but isn't the point of reincarnation... The whole point of it is, each stage, the person comes back, he learns more and more. So what we do as physical, you know, here in the physical world, is can really have no real effect, because we have to see it for ourselves.
Right.
I'm precognitive, I'm psychic, I've astral projected many times. And
you
this
do?
All came about because of something. One day, it came to me. I didn't, you know, it opened itself to me, whatever it is. I didn't, you know, go reading, you know, books or anything like that, and suddenly, poof, you know.
You had an experience.
Yeah, plenty of them.
Steve, you're another person that goes out of body? Everybody in Los Angeles goes out of body, but Bill, you know, I get tired of hearing that.
I've had things where, let's say, my roommate once got hurt in water sports, and I have this, my own way of meditating on things that trouble me and seeking answers that way. And I was able to, I knew before he returned exactly where he went, whether he went to the local clinic to take care of it, maybe it was a minor thing, or to a big hospital. In fact, I knew what time he had returned that night. You know, right now, I knew his whole progress that night.
Let me explain that that people who feel very close to another person, and often is the case with twins, that... The intuitive faculties are developed to the point where there is a connection, where you can feel or know something's happening at the exact moment that it's happening without any confirmation until you get in contact with the person. That's just part of living and being more in tune with your other abilities.
We're beginning to understand the physics and dynamics behind that, in fact, Steve, as we get into...
He was just a roommate. I didn't know him that well. I wasn't really friends with him.
You were close to him, anyway.
A roommate. For example, when the Pope, when John Paul died, and they picked John Paul the First, who died 30 days later, when they pick and they burn the white smoke and the black smoke, I remember sitting there in front of the TV set waiting for the decision of the cardinals of the Vatican, and they're explaining about the smoke, and just it hit me, the smoke's going to come out gray. And the first vote they did, the smoke came out gray, and everyone was confused. And things like that. I lost my boa constrictor one time.
You've obviously had a lot of precognitive things happen to you, Stu. Did we help you here?
You sure did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good night.
All right.
Night.
We have to move on. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Kerry Williams. You're on Open Mind on Talk Radio's Nation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, Society. She co-authored it with Sylvia Cranston, and she is our guest tonight. They've done a lot of extensive research into this really burning subject. Here in Los Angeles and all over the country, people are beginning to take a different view about the reality of reincarnation and get it out of the mysticism of religion and into some factual data.
Yes.
And it seems that the data is so strong about the reality of reincarnation that the burden of proof rests upon those who disagree. And the only source they have is usually the Bible.
Yes,
which is a mystical thing there, because they say God wrote it. And so now we're talking mysticism against a lot of fact. How is that balance going around the world now?
Well, the latest Gallup poll shows that approximately 25% of the American population over the age of 18 believes in the concept of reincarnation. And it was explained, not that that we believe in immortality, but that you re-enter a new body. The definition of reincarnation was explained, and 25% believed in it as of 1982. What's interesting is that Catholics, Protestants, and many of the religions that do not teach reincarnation had very high percentages believing in reincarnation. So obviously, people are taking what they hear and still going on and assimilating their own ideas and concepts as to the meaning of life, the meaning of our own personal existence. And what's really interesting is many people say reincarnationists are just fanciful thinkers. They can't accept the fact that they're mortal, that they're going to die, this is one life, and it's over. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they have to have this glorified idea of immortality.
And they're going to go to heaven or hell.
And bring them back. Well, if you understand that the idea of reincarnation is inextricably woven together with the twin doctrine, its twin, known as the doctrine of karma, reincarnation and karma are inseparable. We have many lifetimes in order to create balance, which is the law of karma, to seek balance and equilibrium in everything we do. Nature seeks an equilibrium. That's why in California we have many earthquakes. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to work things out here, I think.
Well, you must remember, whenever you think, you create energy, and it'll either be harmonious or discordant.
Well, it is. What we attract is the way we color it, sets up and generates that karma. So every thought, action, and deed we generate indeed sets up some force in motion. And that we, through the ideas of karma and reincarnation, are given the opportunity to come back here to work out the lessons we need to achieve this balance. When we are in balance, everything, all aspects of our nature will be in balance, and we will become the pinnacles of evolution, living gods on earth.
The godly being that we are.
Yes, it's here all the time.
Talking about that. You indeed have the power to move mountains, and that's because you have gained this balance and this control over the world that you live in.
Jesus in John 6:2 said he often spoke of his previous eternal existences, and he stated, "You shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before." You know, there are many subtle statements throughout all the teachings of the world, whether it's Christianity or any of the other ideas in other religions, that are there if people just want to read them and see them and experience what is really being said and implied. There's a story in the Bible in which Jesus takes his disciples up to the mountain where he transformed himself into this glowing being of light. And we have so much information regarding Dr. Moody's work and Dr. Stevenson's work and Kenneth Ring's book of the transcendental experience that happens in the near-death experience, in which these people at death see what's been now termed this being of light that is all-loving, that is non-judgmental, that is here to teach us in death the choices and the major choices we made throughout our life, and we are asked to reevaluate again. Did we make, indeed, the best choice that we could at the time? It's a loving, learning experience. There's no judgment at all.
Well, one of my favorite stories is from a dear friend of mine, and I'm not telling anything out of school because he talked about it here one night. He was a NFL football player. In fact, he was a center for the Rams. His name is Art Hunter. Art went on, left the Rams, and went to the Cleveland Browns, I think it was, and it was one of those plays where the entire opposing team keyed in on Art, and they carried him off the field, and he left his body, and he went down the tunnel to the light, and they were, you know, ready to... Art was all over. He got near the end, and he was told, you can't do this. You go back, but don't play football anymore. And he got up off the stretcher and put on his civilian clothes and never played another bit of football, although he's still very involved with the league, but he doesn't play right now. He's an extremely fine stockbroker down in Newport Beach.
Many people who have had this near-death experience, their lives have indeed been changed. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been told to go on and do things or not do things. Many of them are told it is not your time yet.
Right.
Some people are so critical that they're asked, do they want to go back?
Sometimes you don't
want to. Many people do not want to go back because they have now learned that the real heaven is really in the after-death states, and basically
that's
the
home.
Hard work is right here on Earth.
That's
living
home
life.
Over there, and we came to school on this side. Okay, let's go to William. Hello, William.
Hello. I just wanted to come back to... one of the previous subjects that had been discussed about the gurus,
mm-hmm.
As relates to reincarnation, one of the philosophies that I've heard is that we often come back to a society that is in a state of evolution that fits our life where we left it previously in another society, possibly. And one of the things I've noticed about this society is many of the Orthodox religions try to tell you that God is somewhere out there and you are a separate entity from God and you are a separate being. And I think maybe one of the reasons for having a guru is to lead a person past the stage of their evolvement where they have to feel that they are indeed separate from the knowledge. Once you become part of the knowledge again and reunite with that knowledge that is out there, you don't need the guru because you're part of it. But at this particular stage of evolvement, you have to have somebody else to tell you because maybe it's not part of you.
Well, let's look at it this way. We choose what we need for ourselves at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
If people need to follow a guru, they needed it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
When they don't need it anymore, they don't do it anymore. Whether it's a guru or whether it's a relationship or anything else.
Or a book.
Or a book. So people get what they need when they need it. The problem with today is, at least in the Western world, there's so many choices to make that people have to sometimes take the very long way around to get to the basic understanding, as you said earlier, that we are ourselves divine individuals, that we have the potential within us and we don't need a middleman between us and that absolute principle within us.
I think a lot of times, maybe, though, people are afraid that they don't need one.
Don't need a middleman.
Right.
Well,
shouldn't be afraid of that.
it could be either way.
Quite great. When you realize that you don't need the middleman, but you are now going to have to exercise responsibility and determination to become the spiritual person that you were to be, or to... bring on to yourself the nature, character, and personality of the Divine One. That is a responsibility of yours, and only you can do that. No guru can do that for you, nor can any system of ceremony, rote, or ritual. That's yours, and you have to take the responsibility. A lot of people do not want to do that take that responsibility unto themselves. They'd rather do little showy things and then go along being the subcelestial.
That's what I found about this particular society today.
There's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Okay, William?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for contributing to that.
Thank you.
And we have Marina, or is it Mariana?
Marina.
Marina. Hi,
yes.
Marina.
Good evening.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you a question. I do not understand the function of knowing what you have been in your previous lives.
We don't either.
What good can you do anybody to know, for instance, that if they have been a king? Because it seems like most of the time they are always such a tremendous personality in the past life.
We agree.
What good does it do to know that today? Because it doesn't seem like we apply what we have learned, or do we?
No, we agree with you here that it doesn't do us a whole lot of good to remember details.
It's garbage information.
Of who we were, because it just clutters us up and we can't deal with the now.
Uh-huh.
We get too lost in the details of the past to the point where people don't live in the present.
Right.
There are some cases in past life therapy where there have been some physical or mental impairments that are brought over from a previous life, and once you understand that it's from a previous life, it usually goes away in this life, you know, and so perhaps
yes,
there's some good there.
Yes, there are fears and phobias that people have that stop them from functioning adequately in their present life, and once that's understood and resolved, the people can be free to deal with the now.
And it's amazing how some of these physical problems go away immediately under those conditions.
Oh, so you mean it's mostly for the people who have been tormented in their past lives?
No. We're saying that sometimes people, let's say a child who has a severe fear of walking in the street,
uh-huh,
for whatever reason it may be, that sometimes that fear comes from a past life. Once they understand that it has nothing to do with the life now, they can overcome the fear. Do you understand?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So that there's no point in dwelling on things of the past, because in actuality, what you are and what I am and all of us here are at this very moment is a composite of all of our past lives.
And how many lives can anyone have?
You can live as many as you need.
Really?
Well, there are people who say you only have 7 incarnations. If somebody says you only live once. Reincarnation and the ideas say that it's a cyclical pattern that is forever going on, and that we've all had thousands of incarnations here on Earth.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that all of them have to be on Earth.
Right. Well, no, there are other planets of evolution going on, but those of us who are here on Earth are assigned to planet Earth for this lesson.
Oh, I see.
We're here.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you aboard. And Joseph, you're on.
Yes, Bill. I'd like to speak to your guest as to what she may know regarding someone who has made the transition and finds his level on the other side, and how real is it to the soul or to the
yes, that's a very good concept. It, from all of the research we've done, and it's been confirmed by some bodies of esoteric knowledge, that the after-death states are as real and as vivid as what we experience here. But it's an individualized experience. People describe that they see friends and relatives, but in actuality, they're living out, their mind has become three-dimensional. We're explaining things that are very hard to understand, that our mind can be three-dimensional in another plane of existence.
Yes, I understand.
But it is as real as you want it to be. You know, as it is now. If you want to see cities and lights, the experiences of people that we've had on the near-death experiences say that they have seen cities of light. That they see people, they see entities, they understand that they're people.
Well, I've talked to Bill before. The last time I talked to him, he had Edgar Casey's...
Bill Casey, yeah.
He was your guest, and I mm-hmm. called you when I told you that about my contacts and about the errors that existed in the published reports of Casey saying that the great movements of the earth will begin.
Well, Edgar didn't strike it, you know, didn't bat a thousand.
Do you remember when I told you that it was reversed?
Mm-hmm.
It was not 68, it was 86. And take note of what's been happening in the past 2 months.
Well, you see,
been a lot of shaking going on here.
Is that
Edgar Casey was one of the true seers, you know, of our, you know, time.
Yes, he was.
But there were earlier ones, as we well know. There's been many shows on Nostradamus. There's been many prophets. There's been many things said as to the future of the planet. The problem,
George Washington wasn't bad either.
Yes, yes. There was a very interesting article called The Adepts in America in 1776. That was written in Volume 1 of The Theosophist, I believe by Blavatsky herself. And it explained the symbology between the eye and the pyramid on the dollar bill and these great beings and what their purpose was. Lincoln, Washington, and others were indeed great teachers.
And the Masons,
yes.
they were all members of the secret society.
All of the founding fathers were of a metaphysical bent, if you want to give them
exactly.
A thing. They were not religionists.
Benjamin Franklin.
Yes.
Benjamin Franklin, especially. I mean, you know, who goes flying a kite in the middle of the night in a rainstorm?
Well, Benjamin did a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, he certainly did. Listen, Bill, what do you think about that? It was kind of amazing to me that it began in 86. And when I talked to you, I think it was...
That was last year.
December of 85.
Yes, when Jess Stearns and Bill Casey were here.
Yes, do you remember when I called? And,
yes, I do.
And I told you it's reversed, and that's what I got? He says it's not...
Well, the final chapter on the earthquake swarms has not been written yet.
Well, I know, and I came to California.
I've been getting other stuff that I'd like to talk to you about regarding the same thing and what's going to be, and let's see if it does happen, just the way I've been getting it.
Well, anyway, I came to California in 1977, and I was here, I think, less than 1 week, and they had that very big earthquake in San Diego. And so California's been shaken a lot since I've been here.
You should have been in Granada Hills in 1971.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but beware of the witch's night, is what is pretty close to something that I got.
All right, Joseph.
As far as some... You know, some heavy shaking going to take place or begin to take place.
Well, I like to look at it from the lesson that needs to be learned, that if there is this major devastation that may happen to the planet, why is it happening? And it's to bring us back to the purpose that we have to act as one, non-separateness.
Well, how about the influx of souls coming in at such a great rate.
You know why? Wouldn't you want to be where the action is?
I know, but maybe the purpose of destruction is just to take them all out at once when they get too overwhelming for.
Well, you know, it could be overpopulated on the other side right now in the Earth plane.
Oh, no, it could never be because that's where most of us are anyway.
That's home over there.
Yeah, that's right. Most of us are over there.
That's true.
Few of us are here.
That's a good understanding of beings assigned to planet Earth for this period of evolution.
Yeah.
And that it's true, there are many souls out of incarnation waiting to be here on Earth, and they're... That's why there's no such thing as a population explosion. We don't know all of history of this planet. We only know what is available in recorded history.
Right.
Right now, this population that we have today, which is supposedly the largest ever, may indeed not be at all.
Well, they claim that by the turn of the century, which is, what, 16, 15 years, that they're going to double once again the...
Well, I don't think we're going to have 10 million people on the planet by the year 2000, because we have 5 million now.
Well,
but we can handle a lot more if we take care of our resources. And with that, we're going to have to have to stop for the moment and take a break for ABC News. With me is Kerry Williams. It's Open Mind on a Saturday, and then we have it on the table. We have it on the table for you. And Gladys, it's your turn to get on the table. Welcome aboard.
Well, goodie for me.
Uh-huh.
Bill, I wanted to ask Mrs. Williams if she had been prompted in her search on reincarnation by any either personal or near personal experience. In other words, the reason I'm asking it is because I had an experience with my daughter, and my daughter was not brought up on any belief in any particular thing.
Well, I wasn't brought up on any belief in reincarnation either, but from a very young age, I tried to understand why there was such separateness in the world. And I also had my own personal little experiences that no one could explain to me until I was 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally went to every kind of church you could imagine looking for my answers,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't find them until I was walking down the street in New York City on 72nd Street, and I read a back of a periodical that said that I made a declaration that it wasn't an organization, and I made a commitment to my own higher self,
mm-hmm.
and that there were no dues and fees, and I said, higher self, something sounds right. And then the next window had an article opened that the first time I ever read the word reincarnation was when I was 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate enough to find this body of knowledge at the United Lodge of Theosophists, which showed for me the universality and the symbology of all the world religions. And as I went to meetings and found out that everything was impersonal, no one was trying to be famous there, that many great thinkers of our world had indeed come across the same body of information that I did, including Einstein, Freud, Jung, many, many. And theosophy is nothing new. Theosophia means seeker of divine wisdom or wisdom of the gods. And when Blavatsky founded this over 100 years ago, it was said that it was just a current restatement of the ancient, old, immortal truth that has existed since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very happy when I found some information that could help me understand and explain some of the things that had happened to me when I was very, very young. And I, as a teacher from New York City, I saw a lot of my students overdosing and being quite lost and unhappy with their lives, and I became a colleague with Sylvia Cranston, and we decided that we would write this most recent book to talk to the general reader in a narrative type of way, giving explanations that are not our personal opinions but based upon history and fact and scientific data to help people choose for themselves possible other alternatives that may also give them answers. And so people, I think, there are young children, I bump into them all the time on the street, 2 years old, 3 years old, and I'll ask them, who were you? And they will give me an answer, and their parents will be absolutely amazed.
Yes.
And many children, according to our research with I cite Dr. Stevenson because he's one of the most credible researchers in the scientific community today. He's one of the rare individuals that's been published by the Journal of Nervous and Mental Diseases and approved by an American Medical Association journal for research on reincarnation. And so for people who say, where's the scientific information, I have to turn them towards the research of this one gentleman. But his cases are so fascinating, and the information that he portrays is so helpful that parents who can't understand why their children have certain affinities can look into the idea that this child has come with many attributes and talents, like maybe your daughter who believes in this idea or has accepted this idea as being valid for her, and there's nothing wrong with it. And people find out things when they're ready.
Well, I was introduced to reincarnation through reading Emmett Fox originally. And but my daughter is now 42 years old, and possibly 6 years ago we were driving in the car, and we came to a railroad crossing that had flashing lights. The lights were not flashing, but my daughter came to a dead stop and then went on across track. And I said, do you mind telling me why you stopped at that railroad crossing? And very seriously, she turned around. She said, yes, because I was killed in a railroad accident in my last life.
Yes, some people remember very well.
She said, I was between 5 and 6 years old, and I was walking from one car to another and fell down between the cars.
Yes. Well,
and it's very real to her.
I know. In Stevenson's research, he's found many children who remember how their lives ended. And they remember the names of their parents, their friends, their family, everything that
mm-hmm.
you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the strongest evidence we can present for
yeah.
that the memory does exist beyond just the physical body. It survives death.
Well, I think that's the greatest work you are doing, is to help people to realize that the greatest gift that God ever gave us was free choice.
Yes.
And that whatever we sow, we shall reap.
I agree.
It isn't anything that bothers God.
Right. Well, to me, the most harm that's done to people's own evolution is when the responsibility for their lives have been taken away.
Their personal responsibility, that's right.
Right.
And I think it's what we are moving toward, and hopefully we'll move further toward that, because it will solve many of the ills of the world.
Oh, I hope so, too.
All right.
Yes.
Gladys, thank you very much
and
for contributing. Appreciate that very much.
Have a, well, I love your program.
Well, I love you, too.
Thank you. Good night.
I have the nicest audience in the world.
Yes, you do. Thoughtful people.
I listen. They will provoke you. You know, one of my, Frank Baranowski, who works out of the University of Arizona at Mesa, which probably turned my head as much as anything about reincarnation. Now, I came up out of a very fundamental Christian religion in Texas, and we don't get much more fundamental than we have down there. But Dr. Baranowski is a hypnotist, but he used the hypnotist primarily to help you if you were overweight and all of that sort of thing. And a young lady was brought to him who was having all kinds of problems. Her husband had left her, and she had gotten overweight and was drinking and smoking and didn't know why and all of that. And so he started working with her in hypnotherapy for this sort of thing. Shortly thereafter, they went to Hawaii. He went to Hawaii. He was doing a series of lectures over there, and a group of the people who were around him at the university said, this is a great time. So they got one of those tours to go together, and everybody went to Hawaii and see his lectures and see Hawaii. And they went out to the Arizona. And all at once, she became hysterical and said, don't you see the zeros? They're coming in to get us. And was reliving the attack on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor. And he realized that something was wrong with her, took her back, and began then regressing her back into a past life. Try to make this long story short. And she started telling the story of being Seaman John, a young man by the name of John Gillespie. Now, she was 22 years old at the time and living outside of Phoenix, Arizona, and had never been any place else other than that. Gave the name, the address, the location of his family. He grew up in the late 30s. It was depression time. He wanted to help his family because there was very little money. Tried to get into the Army. They wouldn't let him because he was too young. He lied and got into the Navy. He wanted to send the money back and help the family the best way he could. Described his whole movement up to Bremerton, to Long Beach, to San Diego, and finally to Pearl Harbor. Gave names, facts, figures, all kinds of things that were going on in Hawaii at the time. And then described the attack on Pearl Harbor and his own death on board the USS Nevada. It took a long time because a lot of the buildings and the bars and the people and the things were gone that he was talking about, or she was talking about. But a group of investigators from the Orange County Sheriff's Department, in fact, found that these old bars did exist at that time. Even more important was he gave the roster of the Nevada, everybody that was on board. The records of the Nevada were sealed as of December 7th, 1941. And with the help of the representative of and the senator from Arizona and the Secretary of Navy, they opened up the records, the sealed records of the Nevada. And everybody's name was there except John Gillespie's.
Mm-hmm.
But the number was there, but the name was gone. The reason that she divorced her husband is that she is the one who would, or he left her. She's the one who fixed the car. She's the one who mowed the lawn. She's the one who did all of that. And Seaman John Gillespie was an engineer on the Nevada.
Oh. Well, the stories like that happen. We have many of them. Matter of fact, Lord Mountbatten funded a lot of research in England called the Blotsam Tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Similar story. There was a book called Lifetimes that came out a few years ago. Similar story of another ship that was sunk at Pearl Harbor. And this one individual did remember the sinking of the ship. He was on it.
Mm-hmm.
Also gave the roster. Funny, we had cited the research, but the name of the ship had been changed.
Mm.
And we had people calling us in all the time saying, this is incorrect. I was at Pearl Harbor when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that wasn't the way it went. Then we had to write back. Frederick Lenz wrote Lifetimes.
Yes.
And that his publisher had him change the name of the ship to make it more phenomenal, the story.
Yeah.
And then, you know. But anyway, in Lord Mountbatten's research, there was a gunner's mate that was killed aboard ship. And Bloxham was regressing people, this one man, and he remembered losing his leg and then dying at sea. The problem that happened was people who sometimes hypnotically regress and do remember past life, once I call this window or door, whatever you want to call it, that is opened, it's sometimes very hard to close, and it's just like people who have a problem with LSD,
mm-hmm.
flashbacks. All of a sudden, they're caught between two lives.
Right.
1 minute they're on the ship reliving their death, and the next minute they're in who they are now. And that's why it's very hard to tell people to go to a regressionist, because there's a great danger once that door is open. That's why I said when we're ready, we'll experience the opening of these past lives, because we can handle it. We can deal with it and put it in perspective and not be affected by it.
And, of course, in this case of this girl, she ought to once started experiencing it when she got into that environment of Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And so something had to be done there,
yes.
Or she would have gone crazy.
Well, no, I understand. That's why people like Thelma Moss and other people will regress people when they cannot function in the life they're in now.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff that goes on in the world around us. Okay. Let's see what fascinating thing Charles has for us. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Yes, this is quite fascinating. Please bear with the noise out here.
Okay.
Down the shore and an open air phone.
Well, we're putting up a lot of noise here. So.
All right. Let's come in if we can. And I do not know the name of your guest. I just picked up on it about 20 minutes ago.
I mean, Saint Germain has been acknowledged as a very great soul that was here.
Yes, many times.
Yes, well, I can't say how many times. I'm familiar.
Well, I just called to inquire and talk because our precious time we have right now.
Yes. But one of the men who did a lot of research on Count St. Germain was Manly P. Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's...
Who again?
Manly P. Hall.
Okay.
Manly Hall is...
Has the Philosophical Research Society. Madame Blavatsky and the Secret Doctrine addresses St. Germain quite frequently.
Let me ask, if I can, just for a second. In the spiritual point, if you say St. Germain, you stated the I Am. And the fact of the reincarnations we talk about, and the woman spoke of it earlier, how many lives do we ask, or do we have? Do we reach a point where we become ascended masters, like Saint Germain is now? Or, again, I don't know for sure.
Yes.
I'm deeply in deep study right this for me to grow right now.
Okay. We are all masters right now. We're just not acting that way.
Right.
All right. We all have the potential to become that. A great adept teacher like Saint Germain or master, whatever name you want to give it. Elizabeth.
Saint Germain, from where you're coming from, maybe the
there
ascended
are many,
master like Jesus was an ascended master?
Yeah. Let me explain that there have been many great teachers throughout all the civilizations of the earthly existence.
Uh-huh.
Throughout time. There is one book that explains it very thoroughly if you want to understand it better, called Isis Unveiled. It explains the history of all the world religions. Again, it was written by Blavatsky, and it's the most thorough work I know available on the subject.
What is the name of the book again?
Isis Unveiled.
Okay.
And if you...
Is that like the Unveiled Mysteries?
Yes, it is.
In the I Am discourses?
No, it is
not. Or something
not.
Different than that?
It has nothing to do with I Am.
Okay.
Isis Unveiled, The Secret Doctrine, and many other works were written by the founder of the Theosophical movement called Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And it's a very outstanding work, and it has more insight and in-depth information that's not belonging to any one individual. She doesn't state that these teachings are hers. She just states that she's just recording in an organized way the information that's available for our humanity. She is the one who brought the idea of masters and Mahatmas to the West.
Do we, after we become, say, again, I'm studying this, ascended masters, do we we don't continue to reincarnate in earthly beings like we are this way?
Let me explain that. The Buddhists talk about two types of Buddhas, the selfish Buddha and the selfless Buddha.
Right.
All the great teachers that have come, Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, Zoroaster, and all the others, all chose to stay and help humanity.
Right.
All right? A lot of people in the Eastern schools think that the goal is to seek nirvana, indefinite blissful rest.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't an indefinite blissful state. It ends, just like everything else does. So what happens is if you've achieved that pinnacle at your time of evolution and you are indeed offered the choice, as always, to stay and help humanity, those on the ladder behind you, and be a beacon light for them, or enter this blissful state of rest.
Well, like some of the other people are talking about, other states, other dimensions?
Yes, well, the after-death states or the disembodied states or higher planes of consciousness, whatever name you want to give it.
So do we try to get into that ascended state more perfect in each lifetime?
We enter that ascended state every single night in what's called dreamless sleep. Beyond the dream state is the dreamless sleep state, and at that time we are totally free of our earthly body, unrestricted by our physical brains and minds, and we have the ability to experience the knowledge of the world, of the universe, or unlimited potential. The problem is we have to bring it back through the dream state into the waking state, and usually very few people are able to do that.
Does the Maharishi's transcendental meditation, does he talk about that deep thought right there?
Well, meditation is an art that is supposed to help you acquire the disciplining of your mind to be able to concentrate, because very few people, most people's minds operate by jumping around from thought to thought.
I'll sure acknowledge that.
And the meditation is said that the best meditation is what's known as Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga. And there is a book which many people have read to teach that, but not the one put out by the Hare Krishna people.
Uh-huh.
It is the Bhagavad Gita. It is a story. It is a lesson in Raja Yoga. It talks about all the powers that operate. It can be taken on many levels. It's part of the Mahabharata. And there's a translation done by William Q. Judge from the Sanskrit that doesn't have pictures that gives you the very pure translation which is necessary to help you awaken these abilities within yourself. And if you want a book that will help you meditate or teach you what meditation is,
well,
I recommend
that. I was a student of meditation years ago.
Well, Maharishi... He goes around teaching people to meditate on candles and chant their own special mantra,
right,
which isn't very special at all because there's only a few that they use and they just dish them out.
Really?
Yes.
I've always wondered about that. I thought I had the special
mantra. Well, everybody
mantra.
Feels that way, but it isn't really true.
Yeah.
And the term transcendental meditation has always existed. The understanding of what it is has existed always, and transcendental is what happens when you meditate. So it bothers me when somebody puts a trademark on the term transcendental meditation and arrests people that come from a culture that have used that term for thousands of years.
Right.
That's been my experience.
Well, that's our humanness, isn't it? You know, we had to put everything in a little
cubicle. He became very Americanized.
Right.
And so I think we all have to take our lessons. We can all learn to meditate by reading wonderful books that have been written. And we can all become.
Before you go, can I ask you again for the name of that person? There's no cars now. About 5 minutes ago, we talked to that gentleman.
Which gentleman?
On the book that you...
I told you to, if you wanted to read about different things, to read Isis,
yeah.
Unveiled. And it's written...
How do you spell that?
I-S-I-S.
I-S-I-S.
Isis.
Isis.
Okay. Unveiled.
Unveiled. Thank
by
you.
By Blavatsky.
I will do that.
Okay, and then you read the Bhagavad Gita by William Q. Judge.
Okay.
But the secret to meditating, Charles, is to learn how to get quiet and to listen.
Well, that's what it tells you.
I think we always work at that.
That's the most important thing.
Thank you. You set a fine table.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm glad you came.
I waited many years to call the station, but an avid listener to KBC Talk Radio, and this was a moment that struck me to call.
Well, I'm glad you did, Charles.
Have a fine evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Carrie Williams on Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm all right. Hi. I have a question about the reincarnation from human to animals or from animals to humans.
That's a very good question.
Yes, I am a breeder. I'm breeding Siamese cats for years, and some are born unbelievably intelligent since they are thumb size, 3-4 days old. They've developed such strong connection to me, and they just treat me as a mother or like a previous former relative.
I've always thought cats were human anyway.
Well, the teachings, as I understand it, and the research indicates that once you reach the pinnacle of the form on this planet Earth, which is a human being, it's very hard to regress back into a lesser form, such as an animal. But the people in India try to use that as a threat that if you don't behave, follow the caste system, you will be regressed to a lesser form, such as an animal or a
like
tree.
Like punishment.
But human beings are the only form that we have on Earth that give us the ability to have free choice, exercise free will, and make a decision. We have mind and higher mind, while animals operate on instinct. They know how to protect themselves, and instinctual things can be passed on from generation to generation among the animal kingdoms. While plants operate on a different principle, they just bend towards light, which is a lesser principle than instinct in an animal and intuition in a human being. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I had an interesting thing told me by Dr. Peoples, who gets here. Now, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, but he said it very seriously. That in your evolution sometime, your spiritual intelligence, you do need to learn some strange lessons. And in my case, for about 200 years, my spirit invaded a rock.
Yes.
Where I learned patience.
Yes. Well,
and I can't think of anything that would teach you patience more than being a rock.
According to the secret doctrine, it's been said that we, our consciousness, our individuality, in order to become a human, had to go through the experience of all the other forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
Rock is the mineral kingdom, and we did experience the consciousness of a rock. Plant kingdom, animal kingdom, human.
And when you're here, you're...
You've achieved it all.
You're now on the path toward being godly.
Exactly. We have what's called higher mind, lighting up a manas, that principle mm-hmm. that can unite the God principle in us with our mortal form, let's say.
In one sense of the word, you're training the monad.
Exactly.
You are training the monad in those lower forms. Okay, does that help you, Galena?
Yes, and I want to use a chance to say that this third time is the peak of the week for me. And I also tell to all other listeners, they are really a special group of people listening to you, just judging by their questions. And this group has such a strong center as you, Bill. And really, congratulations that we are united very much by you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. They are the nicest audience in the world, too. They are just kind to me. Hello there. Liz, are you on? Liz, I just punched you in and out, but you're on now. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I'm on now?
You're in.
Okay. I changed my mind about what I was going to ask you, but first I want to tell like a little story that happened to me that got me interested in reincarnation and in everything. Several years ago, I was reading Ruth Montgomery's book,
yes.
Strangers Among Us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came to the part where he was talking about Abraham Lincoln being a walk-in, I closed the book, I put it down, I said, I don't think so. I don't think I really believe this. I wasn't sure. So I went into the other room, sat down, turned on the TV, and there was an almanac in front of me. And I just casually flipped it open. And in front of me, in big, bold letters, was the word Lincoln. And I looked down, and it started describing experiences that he had that led up to him seeing double images of himself when he looked in the mirror. And it started kind of all coming together, and I said, this is pretty interesting that I just happened to sit down and open this book after I put the other one down. And so that kind of convinced me that walk-ins could be a possibility.
Well, I think the concept of walk-ins, and you can clarify this if you like, Bill, the way Ruth Montgomery writes about them may not be the way it actually happens. Because being a walk-in means you have let go of your physical body here and an entity has taken over. And usually she says these entities come from other planets.
Really?
Yes.
Because I didn't get that impression.
Well, it doesn't matter. But what happens is great beings such as Lincoln and our founding fathers of this country were definitely inspired, were definitely evolved beings.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say inspired, when people meet a great teacher, a great soul, a Mahatma, whatever name you want to give it, an adept, their lives are affected, and they can be communicated with on many levels. It can be visually, I mean, as if the person would appear right in front of you. One of the greater abilities we have is to separate our astral from our physical, and people who are more evolved or have acquired this ability because of their effort,
mm-hmm.
Have that ability to do that.
That's so, happened to me when I was younger.
The separation.
Uh-huh.
Yes. When we're young, we're less attached to this physical form.
There are some interesting things that happen here, Liz, and I'm familiar with one case here, who is the son of one of our fine executives here at the radio station, that he had a terrible accident and was about, in fact, for all intents and purposes, he was dead. And if he did survive, he would be a vegetable, and it was a very sad situation.
Mm-hmm.
He did recover. He maintains all of the consciousness he had before, but after he recovered, which was rather quickly,
mm-hmm.
he is a totally different,
mm-hmm.
vibrant, energetic, creative person with knowledge and activities and know-how that he did not have
before.
And do
his parents and friends think that he's a different person altogether?
They asked me about that, and uh-huh. I met the young man, and certainly I am not any kind of a person who could give any valid judgment, but
mm-hmm.
it, let's put it this way. It certainly is a case that should be studied in this area.
Well, it happened to the co-founder of the Theosophical Movement, William Q. Judge, when he was very young, became mm-hmm. quite ill and became a different person. A totally different person. And what happens is sometimes the body is sick. It is really finished, and the connection may have been severed. The otic cord, whatever name you want to give that connection between your astral and your physical,
mm-hmm.
which people have seen. Sometimes that body is used by beings who do want to do work, you know, to help humanity.
You maintain the consciousness of the other, but you just take on a
whole...
Yes,
you remember the details of the uh-huh. life, but you're...
I would think the brain would keep the memories. I don't know how relate in a physical
sense. Well, that's the
sense,
middle level
but,
of the monad that's
uh-huh.
at work, and so that part stays with you.
Mm-hmm. One more question. I just had a baby, a little baby boy, and I really would like to get a reading done
mm-hmm.
and find out what our connections have been in past lives. Would you recommend this?
Why do you want to know?
Because I think it would be... There's a reason why we're together.
Okay. As soon as your child can speak, why don't you ask him? And see if
uh-huh.
he remembers. And if he remembers, he'll tell you if you're ready to listen.
Uh-huh.
You
would, and you would
rather have, than a reading.
That's a very interesting answer.
Okay, Liz?
Thank you very much.
All right. Glad to have you aboard tonight.
Bye.
Goodbye. And we have... Is this Rose?
Yes.
Hi, Rose. How are
Hi.
You?
Fine, thank you. Okay, I'm on now, right?
You're on.
Okay. The lady said... sorry, I forgot your name.
That's okay. It's Carrie Williams.
Carrie, I'm interested in what you're saying. I wasn't thinking about your name. Carrie, you said that energy, this energy that we are, has an intelligence. And before we go into another body, this energy, this intelligent energy, you hear of contacts being made to people after someone has died. This energy, does it hang around? I mean,
yes, it does. And
because I've experienced that, I called this program before, but you're the one I should have been talking to.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
There you go.
Okay. it was an intelligence behind this energy, and
yes.
what I experienced, it was actually an intelligence. It came when I least expected it, and it just spoke to me.
Was it someone that you knew?
My husband.
Okay, obviously.
I remember your call.
Yes.
Well, oftentimes, many people who die suddenly have an immense need to communicate with a loved one that was very near and dear to them.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much to let them know that something happened to them, but to let them know that they're really okay.
And
what people see as aberrations or ghosts is that leftover energy that hasn't dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, and in the East, they believe in cremation because it frees the soul from the body quicker. And oftentimes, people who are very sick and terminally ill that are hanging on for life because of their loved ones that they're leaving behind.
Yes.
Always, it's very interesting. I had a friend who was a nurse who did coma research, and patients would wait for her to come on shift to die because she would allow them to die.
Goodness.
And many people keep people alive today by their own will.
We did it for 3 months. He was sick for a year, and it was like he should have been dead 3 months before he died, and on and on and on.
Most people die when their loved ones have left the room,
mm-hmm.
or when they went home for the evening,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, when there's finally a time when they can have a long enough separation that the energy or the will of the people who love them is no longer binding them to their body.
You explained it to A.T.
Thank you. It isn't my personal explanation.
Amazing. Now, one other experience before... Well, this was when my daughter... Well, here, my daughter went to a conscious... What do you call one of these group things where you're
consciousness raising?
Yes. And it wasn't like she was hypnotized, but she was in an, I guess, a meditative state. And she went into this thing where she felt that she was... And I'm going to explain something after this. Like in a round red ball... And she had to get, she was like fighting to get out. And there was smoke. And she's always had, from the time I can remember, a fear of fire. And they had a hard time getting her out of this. And she was just fighting to get out of this round red ball. Well, we were talking about this. And when, just about the time when she was conceived, I was living in a little mobile home with my husband. And he had fallen asleep. I didn't know. I was sleeping in a little back area of this mobile home. And I woke up in the middle of the night. The room was loaded with smoke. He had fallen asleep with a cigarette.
Hmm.
By all rights, I feel I should have been asphyxiated. What would have wakened me? Now, I'm wondering if it was like that spirit. She hadn't been born yet. But could that intelligence behind her, spirit that had entered at the point of maybe 3 weeks into conception, have wakened me?
That's possible, or it could have been your own. When we always have our own higher self or guardian angel or whatever name you want to give it,
uh-huh.
constantly with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're awakened. But there's a very interesting film that was out called Audrey Rose that has a very good element of truth in it. It has to do with people who... or recalling a past life that was very painful, including the death, because at the end of that movie, the child was reliving her previous life and her previous death,
uh-huh.
Audrey Rose. And in the end, they could not save her. She actually relived her death, even though
mm-hmm.
she wasn't in the car that was on fire or burning.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the danger of hypnotic regressions,
mm-hmm.
of opening doors when people aren't ready.
Well, we didn't know if it was like a reincarnation type experience, you know, or something she'd lived before, or was it this a memory somehow of maybe she in the womb was experiencing something that I was going through.
No one can tell you except the true person that can read the astral light, and there's so few people that can do that accurately that just accept that you're all here.
There's a lot of them that think they can.
Yes.
But, you know, you explained it to a T as far as... this experience after my husband died.
Thank you. What I've explained is very well written in a very, as I said earlier, in The Secret Doctrine, it's the only set of information I know that has the esoteric understanding of these questions. And, of course, many researchers we have found verify and confirm the information that is written in that body of knowledge.
What is this book?
It's, well, you can... read any book on theosophy. I would recommend starting with a simpler one first, The Ocean of Theosophy or The Key to Theosophy first. The Secret Doctrine is very hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But all the information is in both of those books also.
You might try also Carrie's own book.
Yes, you
can
read.
That's what I want to read.
Reincarnation, A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society.
Mm-hmm.
And Reincarnation, The Phoenix Fire Mystery.
Okay, so Reincarnation and New...
A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society.
Well, I
and they're available all over town.
Yes, well, you've impressed me tremendously. You're one of... Bill, she's one of the best you've had.
Well, thank you. We thought you
and
were
I do
very
love
very
your
good.
Show. They're all good, but you're really special.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate your call. And let's see. We have Irma on the line.
Yes. Hi. Good evening, Bill. Ed and Carrie.
Yes, it is.
Very nice to talk to both of you. You answered part of my question that has to do with cremation.
Yes.
Now, when the... in your opinion, what is the best method? I understand that cremation is also a form of purification for your soul.
It's a freeing of your connection to the earthly body, which for some people keeps them earthbound for quite a while. It's a setting free of the divine part of you that no longer needs the physical body to exist.
I see. So it is, in essence, a better departing.
Well,
from the third plane, then.
People who have the ability of seeing on the astral plane can go to cemeteries and sometimes see deceased individuals, their astral body, still hovering near their graves.
The out-of-body travelers see this quite often.
Yes.
Is there a certain period of time that a
body... It depends on how attached the person was to their own life and how... hard it was for the family to let them go.
I see.
Their consciousness.
So actually you can set the time that from the time that you depart to the time that you want to be cremated.
You can help a deceased person be free sooner. Mm-hmm. And many people have to make arrangements for their own burials or funerals, usually before they die. In India, it's a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
When people die, they're celebrating because they're free of this physical body, of these shackles.
And in China, they mourn when you're born.
Yeah.
I have another question that has really been puzzling me because I had a similar experience about 16 years ago. When a person is considered brain dead.
Yes.
Exactly. I had a similar experience about 16, 17 years ago where I was hearing the conversations that I was dying or I was dead,
yes.
But I was able to see the people that were there,
yes.
And I was able to hear the conversation.
Exactly.
But it was hard for me to move on my body, and apparently I was just laying there. I couldn't...
Apparently you were really dead, right? And you weren't in your body, and you could see it and hear the conversation. Sure. Could you see your body?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you had an out-of-body experience. Near-death experience, but... many doctors say we'll accept that this does happen to people, and they think you're brain dead because their electroencephalogram little bleeps don't function right. But until that cord that connects you, your physical and astral together, is severed, you can come back to life. And in our book, we talk about many cases, one person who was pronounced dead for 9 minutes. It's an extraordinary length of time. And he was not brain damaged at all. And with the condition that he died from, pneumonia, a very toxic condition, you'd think that there would have been some sort of brain damage. So this confirms the understanding that as long as that thread, the otic cord or the silver thread, even Jesus talks about it in the Bible, is still intact, you can come back to life.
Does that help you, Irma?
It helps.
And that can't be measured.
It helps me. The thing that I know I didn't feel anything. Mm-hmm. I just saw them and I heard them. But some of these people...
That happens quite often.
Do they feel or can they...
They can't feel. They can't move their body because they're not in it. They can't feel because the sense of touch is a physical sensation. But the seeing and the hearing is a more refined sense.
I see.
That belongs to the astral man or the ethereal man.
I see. Well, you really have helped me, and I really appreciate you being there. And
thank
also,
you.
Bill, I really appreciate you being there because I think we need to explore more on this field, and I'm really excited. And I wish it had a longer program.
Thank you, Irma.
Thank you so much, and good night.
Good night.
And in just a moment, we want to talk to Carrie about suicide.
Yes, it is.
Why?
Especially among young children today. What's really amazing is the elementary school age children that are taking their lives. And the basic reason is, as to many psychologists now believe in psychiatrists, that it's due to a fear of nothingness. There's no meaning to their lives. And it has reached epidemic proportions. It's growing in leaps and bounds. And it is now known that people who are attempting suicide, that suicide is indeed, as Mary Sue Miller said, a cry for help. That people who are wanting to commit suicide really do not want to end their life. They really want to be helped. And as I was saying earlier to Rose, that one of the cases we cited in our book is a Sergeant George Ritchie, who did indeed write his own book, Return from Tomorrow, who was pronounced dead for 9 minutes while he was in the military, who had died of pneumonia. He experienced, while he was in his, let's say, out-of-body state, and in which everyone indeed thought he was dead, different planes of existence. He was taken on a celestial tour in which he got to see different states or planes of existence in the after-death states or on the ethereal planes. One of the planes he saw were these entities or beings that he saw were very sad, that were trying to communicate with people on Earth. They were actually seeing their loved ones that they left, that were left behind. One child is begging to his mother and father, please don't be sad. I'm sorry for what I did. Now, can you imagine the torment of a child who took his life, sees the suffering that he left behind, and cannot escape that until the time that his normal death would have occurred? And when I say normal, I mean the time that all his energy for living had been used up. And because of this experience in this book by Sergeant George Ritchie, many people who have committed suicide or attempted suicide have agreed, and we do cite some of this information, that suicide is not a solution. That the anxiety and the torment and the anguish and the suffering that led you to choose the act of killing yourself, you relive again over and over and over again like a broken record. And it's endless until the time of your normal, natural death will occur. And to me, there's no
future.
There's no solution in suicide. It's worse than staying here and working it out.
Very well put. Very well put. That's the worst thing to do.
Yes.
The agony will be greater than what you think you're experiencing now.
The only place to work it out is here. And you need the body to do it.
Thank you, Carrie Williams, for joining us. Your book,
Thank
Reincarnation,
you.
A New Horizon in Science, Religion, and Society. Get it. Next week, a special treat for you. So you join me then. I'm Bill Jenkins.